Today, I'm very honored and pleased to have as guest Denise Icardo, former director of the Division of Healthcare Quality Promotion at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and Dr. David Henderson, deputy director for clinical care, or former deputy director for clinical care at the NIH Clinical Center. Denise and David, it's great to have you on the show, and welcome to Inspired to Heal.
Thank you very much for inviting us on.
Very happy to be here.
So I want to start with David, and for people who really don't understand what a hospital epidemiologist is or does, could you describe what your role is and maybe even a typical day if there is such a thing?
So so first off, let me start by saying that if you wanted to find a typical hospital epidemiologist or in a typical hospital, it wouldn't be my hospital. So that's the first thing I would say about that. A hospital epidemiologist is really charged with preventing the transmission of infections in and around the hospital and in healthcare in general, usually associated with a single institution, but some have more than one institution. They work with the medical and nursing staff to develop policies and procedures to try to make the environment as safe as possible. Hospitals will never be risk-free. But there are lots of things, and we've learned a lot of things over the last few decades that one can do to minimize risk or to mitigate risk in the environment. And that's really what the hospital epidemiologist is charged with. I often divide the job into four parts. One is surveillance for healthcare-associated infections in your institution. Secondly is investigation of outbreaks. Third is education of staff and of each other. And fourth is contributing to science and healthcare epidemiology. And at the clinical center, when I was at the clinical center, and I've been retired officially since 2020, but stayed on when my boss asked me to stay on as a consultant, because you may recall that in January of 2020, some bad things happened. And he thought I might be of some use even at my advanced age. So I stayed around for about 3.5 more years helping with pandemic stuff. But so at the clinical center, let me tell you a little bit about the clinical center. I think you're interested in that. It's the only hospital in the United States that's totally dedicated to clinical research. Every patient who comes to the clinical center comes to participate in a study of one kind or another. There are usually, I don't know how many there are today. Things are a little bit different at the clinical center right now. But when I was last there, there were about 1,000 ongoing studies active, some of them very active, admitting patients every day, and some of them admitting one or two patients a year if they could find them. The clinical center really specializes in rare diseases. When I say rare, I mean, when I was the deputy director of the hospital, a new disease used to cross my desk about every other week. That should give you some idea about the scarcity of these patients. Sometimes there may be only 12 or 15 of the patients in the world. But we have, at the clinical center, we had the world's expert in the gene product, protein or whatever was abnormal in these patients, and they wanted to study those patients because they could learn more about human physiology and in the course of doing that, learn how to take care of these patients better and more safely. The other half of our studies, half are really what I would call natural history or disease pathogenesis studies, and those are usually the patients who have rare and genetically determined diseases. The other half of the studies are clinical trials, and even the clinical trial portfolio at the clinical center doesn't look like the clinical trial portfolio at most other academic centers. Most academic centers have ongoing clinical research, but most of their studies are phase 3 and phase 4 trials. At the clinical center, the last time I looked, I think 93% of our studies were phase 1 or phase 2. I doubt that there's another hospital in the world that has that kind of portfolio. And when I was saying that the hospital epidemiologist at the clinical center has a different sort of job. It's because we have all these new drugs, all of these new things that are going on, and there's a different level of risk associated with that, those kinds of studies.
Yeah, could you quickly define a phase one or phase two for people who are not familiar with those terms?
Yeah, phase one studies are first in human studies. So it's the first time the drug or device or whatever has ever been put into people. And phase two studies are just slightly expanded. And during phase two studies, they often do dose finding to find the best dose or the highest dose you can give without toxicity. Phase three trials are efficacy trials generally to show that the drug or device or whatever you're studying actually works to do what you think it does. And then phase four studies are post-marketing studies. So once a drug has been marketed or a device has been marketed, people study it to look for rare events or rare complications downstream. And then also, I think in this day and age, phase four studies often entail having a drug being studied someplace other than an academic center. So does it really work out in the real world as opposed to in a strict environment? Mm-hmm.
So the NIH Clinical Center really is one, it's a lifeline for patients around the country and perhaps around the world who have a rare condition. But also it sounds like it's a place, it's hard to do a study when you have one person, you know, spread across a region and you're able to bring them together and actually do that. So the lifeline for patients, the ability to study rare diseases, but also the proximity of laboratory research is kind of, you know, the best scientists in the world working with some of the best clinicians in the world to solve problems.
Yeah, no, it is a simultaneously wonderful and terrifying place to work. The great thing about working at the clinical center, and I can say this, I feel like I'm positioned to say this because I worked there for 45 years, is you get to work with an enormous number of smart people. And I mean really smart people. That's the good news. The bad news is you get to work with an enormous number of smart people. And that can be harder than you can imagine because they all think they know how to do your job. In addition to being the world's expert about something, they can tell you, they'd be happy to tell you how you should be doing your job. So it's one of the unique things about the place. But it is a treasure. The clinical center is a national treasure that almost nobody knows about.
Mm-hmm. It brings up a couple of questions when you have clinical trials and protocols that you have to adhere to, and you have guidelines for infection control. Did they ever come in conflict with each other?
Oh, absolutely. We work with our investigators to try to make it as safe as we could. Let's imagine that you're using some live virus vector for some kind of gene experiment, and they've never used this vector in humans before. You don't know whether it gets spread, whether it actually multiplies in a person. So all those things have to be thought through up front. And the review process to get such a study done might take eight or nine months. Just of carefully looking at everything. It's like doing an incredibly intense failure modes and effects analysis up front with these studies to make certain that there's nothing that can go wrong or that if something does go wrong, we know how to manage it.
Mm-hmm. And being in the unique position at the clinical center that you had, are there anything over your, 30 plus years of working there that you could point to that, you know, maybe this advance would not have happened, not just clinically, but maybe in hospital epidemiology?
Well, there are lots of examples. I think we were among the first in hospital epidemiology. The thing that we probably got recognized early on about was something that Denise mentioned, and that was We very early in the HIV epidemic, our colleagues who worked downtown in DC called up the director of NIH and said, "What is this new disease and what are you doing about it?" And so we very quickly had literally hundreds of AIDS patients admitted to the clinical center at a time when no one really knew what caused it or the epidemiology was, I think we were pretty confident about the epidemiology, but not entirely. And the healthcare workforce in the clinical center was terrified. And so we began studying occupational risk in that setting. And it was a perfect setup because these patients were coming through the door like crazy. The healthcare workers were motivated to make certain that we could learn as fast as we could about the risk. And so we actually learned a lot about factors that contribute to risk for occupational exposure and occupational infection. And so that's how I got to know Denise, because I got to be a consultant to CDC on this very issue. I don't know how many times, Denise, 20, 30? That's a big number. But
many times.
Yeah, many. Yeah, a lot. And the other thing that happened is we had a very unfortunate event early on in the epidemic. We had a healthcare worker who got infected. It was a woman working in our transfusion medicine department who did something I had done thousands of times in the laboratory. She was spinning down serum in a red top tube. She took the pipette after it had spun and pipetted off the serum. And she had the stopper in her fifth finger, and she cranked the stopper back into the tube. The sidewall came out of the tube, and she cut her hand. 16 days later, she was febrile and developed the acute retroviral syndrome. And about 2.5 years later, she died. This was before any retroviral treatment or post-exposure prophylaxis was available. And so because of that, Sam Broder and his colleagues in the Cancer Institute were studying a drug called BW509U, I think, which turned out to be zidovudine. Mm-hmm. And there was early evidence in the clinical center, and this is a great example of what you could do in the clinical center that you might have a hard time doing elsewhere, especially studies done by Phil Pizzo when he was in the pediatric branch of the Cancer Institute. He had infusion studies of children born with AIDS who would literally wake up with the infusion of zidovudine. It was astounding to see it. And so with this in mind, I went to the medical board of the clinical center and said, listen, we have this drug, which we know has activity. If we have healthcare workers who have occupational exposures, don't you think we could offer them? They don't not require them because it was an experimental drug, but if they wanted to take it, they could take it. And then we could study that if they want to take it. And so we started doing that. It did make some of my friends in Atlanta unhappy at the time. They thought we shouldn't be doing that, but we did it.
It wasn't me, Bill.
It wasn't.
We'll give you. We definitely need to hear the CDC story.
It was a different person. A little bit. Yes.
But simultaneously on the West Coast, my good friend and colleague, Julie Gerberding, had access to the drug and was doing the same thing. And so we very quickly became very close friends and worked on that together. Really, I think probably Julie and I were the driving forces behind offering post-exposure prophylaxis in the country. At a time when I think, Denise did the benchmark study. You don't show efficacy in this kind of trial, but the data were so compelling that in her New England Journal of Medicine paper that said that healthcare workers who took zidovudine had their risk reduced by 79% or 80%, and that really was it was astounding to me. I thought we were doing the right thing, and the reason that we did it was to be advocates for our healthcare providers and, to give us something that we could offer to these people who are otherwise terrified when they had these exposures. And lo and behold, it turned out to work, and it's turned into a cottage industry in the United States now.
And Bill, they were really critical for everything. Like the study I did was just put two and two together for the things that they were doing. But because the trial that they were trying to do, it didn't work. Nobody wanted to be in the control group.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's
so
right.
They couldn't do it. And that's, but everything we did when I came to CDC, everything we did was working, was based on what David and Julie were doing and really complementing each other. And, but if it was not what they were doing, we probably were not even having now pre-exposure prophylaxis for non-occupational post-exposure, like for perinatal transmission. So it was a lot of really innovative and not easy because many groups were against.
Oh, yes. No, I mean, we took a lot of heat, but we did it as an open label trial. I tried to do it. I tried to get FDA approval to allow me to do it, but they wouldn't let us. They wouldn't. They said, you can't. We can't give you an IND for this. So because the drug was already marketed, and even though it was a unique indication, it wasn't unique enough for the FDA at that time. But we persevered. We just did the study, and we recognized that we would never accumulate enough stuff at one site, or even Julie and I together couldn't accumulate enough data to complete the study. But once UCSF and the NIH Clinical Center started doing it, a lot of people started doing it all around the world, actually. That's how Denise was able to collect the information she did, which turned out, I think, to really make a huge difference in how we manage these exposures.
And David, the IND is an investigation of a new drug.
And so investigational new drug, right. So if you want to do a study with a new drug, I'm sorry, I'm presuming our audience knows a lot of things that I
most will, but
so I apologize for that. But yes, we couldn't get an IND. It was so painful because I don't know if you've ever done this, but if you try to put together an IND packet, it ends up being about that thick. And so they made me do it all the way through, and then told me that they wouldn't give it to me.
Well, sorry about that. it's good that you persevered. And, I really, if Denise, you could suspend some humility and just kind of talk about that study, which was really important and probably saved, saved countless lives. I myself remember being stuck with a needle in medical school when it was also early on with AIDS and being embarrassed, but having no resources. And fortunately, didn't contract anything, but I think it happened to quite a few medical students and physicians as well.
One of my favorite questions actually is, why is that risk so small? I mean, the risk as measured by Dr. Cardo and her colleagues and our team is about 0.3% per exposure for a bloodborne infectious disease. Mm-hmm. That question is still not completely answered in my mind.
Denise, what would you like? You did this important study. And I think if I remember reading it, I refreshed and I think there were only 33 cases. So, or 33, go ahead. Transmission maybe.
Again, the study was possible because of all the work that David and Julie did before, they were still doing it. And then because of that, many countries start using AZT. We didn't know. It was to look at risk factors, like why is 0.3? It can be higher if the risk is higher, if you have a deep wound. So it was more to look at this. And it was a big surprise when we saw not that we didn't expect. I didn't expect the study to show that result for post-exposure prophylaxis.
And nor did I, Denise.
So we did all kinds of analysis. We tried to see, okay, something is not right. But it continued. So the interesting thing to me, Bill, when we published the study, people were criticizing. First, they were saying, you were recommending AZT, now they are new drugs. I'm like, I'm not recommending anything. We're just doing with the drugs people were using. It's just a concept. And going to some of the HIV meetings, I remember telling people, I'm going to wear impermeable suits because the experts would say, it doesn't make any sense. And you guys in healthcare epidemiology don't know what you're doing. So it was, I'm like, I'm so sorry. That's the result. So it was very, for me, what was interesting, not this, the study was interesting, but how to make from one finding plus a lot of background information to make a policy for the country and right. how to adapt that to different realities. That for me was a very interesting and amazing experience because then we had to recommend. We had to say as soon as possible. We didn't know exactly the interval. And we put EG 2 to 3 hours. We had to move that because there was like lawsuits if they're not getting EG. I was like, it's for example. So it was clear to me how much we had to be careful with the words because although it was a guideline, it became really an enforcement document. And but also then, okay, what do you do with the dentists? What do you do? We knew how to do in acute care. So it really showed how much we had to work with partners to adapt the guidelines implementation to get to what we wanted, is that people will get the drugs as soon as possible. So it was very interesting. And then after that, we start looking at cases that didn't work. Let's analyze the failures of post-exposure prophylaxis. And it was easier because we could do sequencing, so we could see if it was the same as the source. So it was, I always say, people think that the paper is the end. The paper was the beginning of many, many things that we end up doing. And then until now, we see a lot of impact. And then it started like, okay, but let's prevent the injury. So realistic prevention. So it was really, and the unions were upset at us because we didn't want just to recommend one specific device. So it really helped me when I became a division director to have the perspective and how you really go from a finding, a very important finding, to guidelines and implementation for huge impact. It's yeah. It was interesting.
Yeah, I love that. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, David, please. Yeah.
Now, I love Denise's study because I love things in medicine that make sense. And Denise's studies, except for the finding of the drug, made perfect sense. So it showed that if you stuck yourself with a hollow bore needle, you were more likely to get infected than if you stuck yourself with a surgical needle. If you had a deep injury, more likely to be infected compared with a superficial injury. I guess the third one I remember is if the person was late in illness and died within a certain amount of time.
So it was,
death.
Yeah.
Right, right. And so all those things are an ocular effect. Mm-hmm. That just makes implicit sense.
So,
Then there was the AZT finding
that
was prevented. And if you think about it, all those experts who hollered at us, that makes sense because we don't typically prevent viral infections with drugs. We prevent them with vaccines.
Yeah.
And Dr. Fauci was hoping that any day we would have a vaccine for HIV, which just we've never gotten to. But that's not – so this was non-traditional, to say the least. Mm-hmm. I do love that study. I quote it every time.
Yeah. What I wanted to comment on was in the prior interview that I had in someone in public health is that
you froze, Bill. Can you repeat?
You froze for a second there.
Okay. Sorry about that. So can you hear me now? Am I good? Okay.
Yep.
In the microwave safety episode that I just also recorded, they published the risk and decided that they wanted to take a public health approach. And by the public health approach, And this isn't demeaning to academics, but you get to the publication, you have your finding, you publish it, and then you need somebody or some entity or organization to follow that through, which is the long, hard pathway to get this into be a policy or to influence a regulatory agency, and the value of having public health there to do that. I mean, that's what you spoke to, is that was the beginning. The paper is the beginning of your work.
Yep.
Could you also, I think now it's much safer for patients and for healthcare workers, and post-exposure prophylaxis is one thing, but I think there are engineering
Denise talked about the difference between primary prevention and secondary prevention. Primary prevention is preventing the injury, and if you can prevent the exposure, no one's going to get infected. And so once we had our infection, I worked with our hospital safety officer, and we created a protocol through which, with every single occupational exposure that got reported, and I say the ones that got reported because they surely don't all get reported, she would sit down with them, interview them, look at the circumstances of injury, see if there was a piece of equipment that might be flawed or that might have contributed to it, see if there were work practices that may have contributed to it, and we would then process through and change our procedures if we needed to try to make the environment safer. And I have this great slide that just shows occupational exposures reported to the Occupational Medicine Service dropping over time, over years, as we just continue to do that as an iterative process to try to make those exposures go away. And we pretty much, almost, not quite, but pretty much put ourselves out of business.
Yeah, I'm sure that business comes and goes.
Yeah, it does.
As we see with COVID and such. Yep. But I particularly just, one thing is the needle, the engineering for the needle design, to recap the needle without you having to put your hand, hold the cap with one hand and thread the needle into the cap with the other, which was our practice. Mm-hmm. I don't know, did you play a role in that redesign at all, or was that done through other entities?
So that's really the work that Denise and her team at CDC do. They really were, I think, world leaders in making the environment safer through both engineering controls, work practice controls, development of procedures, and so on. We still have some recapping that goes on in the clinical center. There are some places where they have to do it, but we developed a workaround. We developed an engineering control so you don't get your hand down near the needle to recap it. And we've not had, by the time I left, we've not had any exposures associated with that device. But CDC has done a magnificent job, I think, of emphasizing, educating healthcare providers and staff who have occupational risk how to behave to avoid those exposures.
And Bill, it's the role for CDC is, like David is saying, is highlighting the issue, is promoting education, is promoting more ways to prevent, not just exposures, infections, for example. CDC does not develop products or test products. CDC doesn't do that. But CDC will have some analysis of risk factors, of circumstances, of things that can allow industry to address. So this is not just for needlesticks. This is for everything in our field in healthcare epidemiology. So it's like, for example, with the epicenters, through the work of the showing how transmission was occurring, the issue with the skin, that chlorhexidine. So it's a lot of partnerships that not just with industry, but with academic centers that move towards that. But CDC does not develop a specific device. We cannot endorse a specific device unless it's like 100% and it's the only one. And that's the reason it was having HCPAC, the healthcare infection control practice advisory committee, was very important because they will look at all the data and decide which device, which approaches that we do have data to show that we should recommend. I'm just saying this because sometimes people would come to CDC, can you approve my device? And it's like, that's not the way it works. Mm-hmm. And we have to be very careful. And that's the reason HCPAC was created.
Mm-hmm. I think the HCPAC would be analogous to the ACIP or the Advisory Committee for Immunization Policies.
Yes.
One that's very topical and controversial at the moment. But those advisory committees convened by federal agencies, CDC, NIH as well, brings together national and international experts to review the literature, to understand the possible unintended consequences and the adverse effects, but what really has been proven to work and what should we promote through guidelines, which again, it's not regulatory, but it's a guideline that people can follow across the country.
Yeah.
Denise, what are the other, so you clearly worked with NIH, you worked with David. What are the other federal agencies that you felt were important in sort of cross-agency partnerships? Who did you work with at CDC to make sure patients and healthcare workers were safe?
So when I came to CDC, I worked a lot with David because of occupational exposures and occupational HIV. When I became a division director, I was lucky that Dr. Gabbardine was the director of the division right before I was. And she already had started some collaborations with federal agencies, like the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, and a few other agencies. What happened when I was right in the beginning, Bill, of becoming a division director, policies became a big issue. And demands from the public became a big issue. That's when public reporting for the state perspective started. And the states start having legislation that it was the consumer groups pushing for legislation for public reporting of the healthcare-associated infections data by hospitals. And then CMS, because of Congress saying the Deficit Reduction Act, they should not pay for the infections or the extra amount. So we saw the importance of not just working with CMS in a more, not just let's be friends, but let's work together, but also with the states. Because if we didn't, each state would have a new definition for HAIs. So that's when, again, HCPAC play a role because HCPAC had a guidance and what states should be doing. We started working with NHSN and offering the National Healthcare Safety Network to all the states that had public reporting. We adapt to them. But when you got to CMS, we're friends. But not exactly, we got along, but they were not using our tools. So what was needed was a GAO investigation. And I always remember Chesley Richards was my deputy, going to meet with Sarah Dupre and Stephen Shaw, who were working for Waxman. And they said to us, look, you have this paper showing 70% of infections can be prevented, catheter-related bloodstream infections. Why are you not working with CMS so all the hospitals are doing that? We're like, we would love to.
That's why you were there.
But they're like, every time I go there, they're like my friends. They give me candies. But So they did a government accountability office investigation. And what it showed, it was at the end of Bush's, President Bush's administration. What showed is the agencies were all working in healthcare associated infections, but not together. And he said, guess what? You have to work together. So it became, they had a hearing and they said, we want an HHS action plan. And we want to know what each agency is going to do. So don't think that we're just, oh, let's work together. We had to work together. and so...
When Julie was the director at CDC, she also got all of the agencies to have representatives at the HCBAC meeting, which put people all around the table listening. It's really, I used to love to go to those meetings. I always sat in the corner, tried to keep my mouth shut. I failed on many occasions.
No, you fail all the time. But it was fantastic. But again, we were just talking. Mm-hmm. We are bringing information back and forth. We didn't have the commitment of the leadership. We had from Julie, from when she was the CDC director, but not from the others. So with this GAO and the HHS action plan, that, by the way, we had already developed, Chesley, we all had put together, but it couldn't be just CDC. So Don Wright, Dr. Don Wright was great, saying, okay, let's have all the agencies together to make it happen. So David, myself, the CMS person, PJ Brandon, who was HCBAC, we even went to HHS to define the infections that were going to be included. And I don't know if David remembers, but MRSA was included because, don't include this in there, because the deputy secretary said, why? My father had this. They told my father he had a staph infection. It's important. I want this to be included. And we were like, okay. MRSA was included because of that. But anyway, so... And then it became what we did, Bill, was to take that seriously. We took that seriously and we make, we really worked together. Yeah. So then it was with CMS, with ARC.
AHRQ.
AHRQ.
Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality.
Healthcare Research and Quality. With FDA, not as much, but with FDA. And with NIH, especially for specific, with David. And with HRSA is, I even wrote it here, the Health Resources and Services Administration. Mm-hmm. So each group had a different role. But it was, so it was really, it became a big, big shift in how we did business. And just to give a perspective, when it was President Obama administration, they had prevention of HAI as...
I'm sorry, Denise, I'm going to give a little primer. the healthcare associated infections. HAI.
Uh-huh. HAI. They had that as what they call the HHS, Health and Human Services, priority goals. Mm-hmm. Yep. We had to sit with in front of the deputy secretary and show if we are going up or down in the goals and why. It was CMS leadership, it was CDC, FDA, NIH. And if it was not, we had to say, okay, and what we're in ARC, what are we going to do to change? So it became really a very important piece with CDC. Can I say one more thing?
Of course.
Because we were just, in the beginning, it was just hospitals. It was a hospital problem. When we showed that it was possible to prevent, and with the studies from Peter Pronovost and also from CDC in Michigan and Pittsburgh, it was, again, we had the HHS action plan, and President Obama was elected, and it was... Recovery Act. So Michael Craig, who was working with me for the policy, and I were invited to meet with Nicole Kunkel, who was working for Representative Obi from Wisconsin. And she said she had all the papers. They knew everything. And she said, okay, the representative is very impressed with this. And he wants to have this in all the states. How much would cost for us to have a program for all the states to have prevention of healthcare-associated infections because we want to protect people? Mm-hmm. We said $50 million. We said, okay, $1 million per state. And so Recovery Act had $50 million for prevention of healthcare-associated infections, $10 million for CMS, and $40 million for the states. And CDC was the only group that had funding for the states. Mm-hmm. So it was the first time public health was funded to really work in healthcare-associated infections. Mm-hmm. And for CMS, he did one more thing. There was a block grant at CDC from chronic diseases that states could get whatever. For a state to get money from the block grant, they had to have a plan to address healthcare-associated infections. Mm. So they were the ones who connected. And I decided, you know, it's our time. So in working with the CMS, still now, we have a person, they have a person from DHQP at CMS, and we exchange money and everything. So it became a big issue.
Denise, you were quite exceptionally skilled at getting collaboration across these agencies, and I've seen you in action. Did it come naturally, or what did you learn during your decades of leadership? And maybe what did you wish you knew when you started that you learned over those decades?
I learned a few things. First, having Julie Gerberding as division director. I think you were there, Bill, because for the annual report, she would say, tell me the impact. And we say, we published this and this and this. And she's like, no, how many infections were prevented? And we're like, oh, we cannot show that. Yes, you have to show. So it was a way for me to really embrace, yes, we're here to protect people. We're here to prevent infections. We need to show that. We're not an academic center. We're public health. Second, when it was public reporting, there was it was during Bush administration. We're doing pretty good helping the states and everything, but we couldn't say you have to do it because there was no data showing. And there was a hearing, and they asked me to represent HHS. And I was at the hearing, and this specific representative, it was an oversight committee. Nobody explained to me what an oversight committee was. And he would say to me, Dr. Cardo, how many hospitals have you closed? Dr. Cardo, you are killing people. I'm like, I'm not killing people. And then I realized he was asking about HHS. He was asking about CMS. And I had to say, I work with CMS. When I left, I was like devastated. And somebody said, don't be concerned, it's not your role. And then I thought, no, it is my role. I cannot just show what infections are happening. If I really believe in preventing those infections, I have to work with the ones who make that sustainable. And that's when, Bill, we put together the concept of elimination program. That is kind of what David said, that includes data for action, prevention initiatives with incentives aligned, preparedness and outbreak response, and innovation. So I thought, we have to work with the people who would do that. We're just saying the what. We need to really work with the ones who can make it happen. And that's the reason I really took that as very important. And having the patient perspective, the the consumer groups involved helped because they were so upset at us. They would say to me, how do you think it's okay to have this? They would say, why you guys, we, the healthcare epidemiologists, only want to eliminate the preventable infections. They say, why are you the only ones who want to eliminate the preventable infections when everybody wants to prevent all the infections? That's when I thought, okay, we do too. So how do we change that? And how we as healthcare epidemiologists, SHE, APEC, CDC, we are kind of losing our space because everybody was coming with solution and it was not us. So that's when we all again sat together and said, let's be together, let's partner, let's make it happen, let's be the voice. And so that's when I really took that my role as a division director was not just to have great papers from the division, but to show that we're making a difference. And then working with CMS, working with FDA, working with NIH, working with the patient groups, working with the professional organizations, working with everybody was the only way to make that sustainable and not just our problem. It became something that, and also not just the bad ones, everybody became bad. So we did that. We were able to have stewardship programs in all hospitals, including rural hospitals, working with the Federal Office of Rural Health Policy. We have been able to really have programs in all the states, show progress. And then I learned that it's better to be ahead than to follow, because they would call everybody before they would call us, members of Congress. So we had to say, no, it's not like that. So we changed. And with AR, we became the ones that were the reference. So that's the reason we published the threat report.
That's the AR being an antibiotic
AR
resistance.
Antimicrobial resistance.
And the threat report that we're developing, untreatable or difficult to treat infections?
No, it was how big is the problem? How big is it? Because we would say, this bug is this amount. This is how big is the whole problem about antimicrobial resistance? Mm-hmm. So we put a report together that not for New England Journal. It was for New York Times. It was good enough to move forward, but it was not to be. And this, in addition to that, we're able to then have Dr. Frieden, who was the CDC director, to understand the problem. And we did some modeling showing if we don't intervene, things are getting worse. So he took this to the Secretary of Health and Human Services, then to the White House, and it became a national initiative to combat antimicrobial resistance. Mm-hmm. So I'm just saying, how was the learning process?
Yeah. So one thing I want to ask both of you is the we've talked about things, HAI, healthcare associated infections, and the big ones or the common ones, the ones that cause the most frequent problems for patients and the most morbidity would be surgical site infections, urinary tract infections associated with a catheter, bloodstream infections often related to the catheter that we put in patients, and pneumonias that people get, whether or not they're on a ventilator. You both have been in the field for a long time. What do you think are the biggest advances? If you could pick, one or even all of those, what do you think we do differently now that has saved, prevented infections and saved lives?
In my view, what do we do different? We not think about just the infection. We think about the patient. The patient that has many devices, many risks in treating the patient. And I think I think we had a huge impact in the dealing with the devices.
Yes.
huge impact to a
and
point
I'll tell
that
people Denise was pointing at her one of her veins.
Yeah.
We put
yeah.
the device in the vein and so we changed how we do that.
So we changed and we showed that it's preventable. Then we start seeing that the other sources, the environment, the microbiome. And so now we're addressing that too. So the way I feel, Bill, but I have a bias on that, is embracing the concept that we need to prevent all the infections and how we use innovation and data for that is helping us not just to be stuck in the device related, but it's helping us to really move ahead. We're always going to be surprised, always. Yep. Never take anything for granted. Mm-hmm. I remember in the beginning, while we were talking about bloodstream infection, I would give a talk in which I would show bloodborne pathogens being transmitted because of injection safety, people using the same needles in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Between different patients, the same needle.
Between different patients. Or a single dose vial to more than one person. So I always say, don't take anything for granted, because I think the huge challenge is to say, yes, those things are not acceptable. For me, this is the best success that we have had, not just for healthcare epidemiologists, but for patients and clinicians and society overall.
I think from my perspective, I think it's taking that the epidemiological approach that Denise's been talking about for all of these problems. And so looking at sort of the global problem of device-associated bacteremia, let's say, and starting from the very beginning, like should we be wearing sterile gear when we put these catheters in? How should we clean the skin? Analyzing every single thing that we're doing to try to make certain that we're mitigating risk the best way we can. And I think that's the approach that CDC has taken to all of these different classes of infection. Some of them are easier than others. I think the you mentioned healthcare-associated pneumonia. It's still something of a mess, I think. It's hard because it's multifactorial and it's very hard to, you pull on one thing and everything else comes out the other side. You can't really pin it down the way you would like to. The way I think we did, I think, extremely well with device-associated bacteremia. I mean, that's a great example, but it's the example I gave you of processing through every single exposure that we had back in the dark ages to look at what are the factors that contributed to those exposures. That sort of approach to these kinds of problems is what CDC has really led us through over the last three decades. And it's been unbelievably successful.
Mm-hmm. Bill, can I go back to the partnership in one thing? Mm-hmm. Because when we talk about working with other agencies, working with partners, one thing I learned from working with my colleagues, especially in the Washington office, was there is no, you know a person, you like a person, you trust a person. It doesn't jump from no to trust. It's a process. And in partnerships, you need to get to a point of trust. You don't need to agree, but you have to trust. So you don't second guess the intention. Mm-hmm. And this is like no surprises. I used to have monthly one-on-one calls with the president of SHEA and the president of APIC to discuss things I could not talk in public. So they will know what was going on and hear their perspectives. Because the worst would be a surprise. Mm-hmm. And the same thing with CMS. And when people ask me during COVID, how come you work so well with CMS? You guys were able to address nursing homes. You were able to do this. I said, because we develop a trust and we talk and we share things. So even we don't need to agree, but we need to agree in the how. We need to agree in what we want to accomplish. Mm-hmm. David and I had conversations many times over a wine, but about PPE. David and
Sorry,
personal it's like equipment. Especially the respiratory protection, because mm-hmm. David would deal with very rare diseases in which he needed highest protection, and I had to have something for the whole country. So we would talk, and despite we different perspectives, but the trust helped me to see how to address and help David to even help me and others. So I say this because it's not just a meeting, it's not an encounter, it's an ongoing really work in which you have to really have leadership engagement, and also the people working in a level have to be working together. So I'm not at CDC anymore, and people continue to work with CMS.
Yeah. So, David, I think what Denise brought up about the protective equipment, you were quite challenged by when in reading your biography about your accomplishments at NIH, is that you had to prepare the clinical center for Ebola in 2014. So you received patients from who had it and were exposed. And I just wanted to hear a little bit about that experience, and maybe, you know, you probably tried to prepare what slipped through the cracks, and you thought, oh my gosh, we didn't anticipate this. But
for us, I think that's a great success story. It was a wonderful success story, and it started out by doing almost exactly what Denise said, rather than focusing in on just the infectious diseases community, we put everybody in the same room and said, okay, we're going to bring these patients here. We want to make the environment as safe as we can. And this went from the CEO's office all the way down to our housekeepers. And we would sit in a room. This is before we had any patients where it was only just theoretical. We developed procedures, strict procedures. The reason we were doing this is we were fortunate enough to have actually the military who had a facility in Frederick where they studied special pathogens. And they sometimes had occupational exposures, and they had a place where they put those people that was referred to as the slammer. And it was as bad as it sounds. Mm-hmm. And so Dr. Fauci was then the director of NIAID, and he worked with Congress and the military to get funding to build a facility that would make care for people who had those exposures safe for our healthcare workers. And then we had to train our workers. So we trained the staff, we developed procedures, and we got everybody on board, and we practiced and practiced and practiced. And then after the first patient came, fortunately, it was a healthcare worker who had an exposure who didn't ultimately get infected. We met at 3 o'clock every day following the person's admission and went through the list of things that didn't work or didn't work the way we thought they were mm-hmm. going to or things. And we learned from that experience. The team functioned extraordinarily well. We did not have a single occupational exposure among our healthcare workers who provided care, I think ultimately for someplace in the neighborhood of 10 Ebola patients, one of whom is the sickest patient I've ever seen survive. I mean, he was really sick. But we were able to do that. Plus, everyone was on the same page. So we had the housekeepers who knew what to do. We had phlebotomists who knew what to do. We had everyone had their jobs. And we used the water and sanitation approach, Watson. We had a Watson who watched everything as someone was coming in and coming out of the room, stopping people. And it was just, it was incredibly successful. It was probably the most fun I had in my job at the clinical center was putting that team together mm-hmm. and then just watching it go. It was wonderful.
And for me, it was terrible. because not what he did. What he did showed that what we are recommending worked. And so we had to do that for the whole country. And we underestimated how hard it would be for people to follow. And we had a transmission. It was one of my worst days. I thought I was going to be fired. I thought I was going to be fired. I remember going back to work the next day. The staff in the HQP, they were like almost crying. And I thought, I'm not going through this. And I said to them, it happened. I don't want to point fingers. It's a problem with the system. How we fix the system. It means people cannot follow. So we changed completely our approach. We end up getting lots of money to really have groups to go and observe and to do things. And Dr. Frieden called me in his office. And I went with Arjun and I said, okay, it's okay. I said, Arjun, if he fires me, it's okay. And then we sat and he said, what do you think? I said, we underestimate, and I don't want to start blaming. I just want to see what we're going to do from now on. I take the responsibility, but we need to do something that is different. I was not fired; exactly the opposite. But it just shows how much what we recommend works in a very controlled environment. And that's the reason more and more I believe we need to have special places. In that time, I didn't think it was needed.
So, Denise, this transmission occurred before you had designated sites as places to receive?
They were designated sites, but also people could, this person, they were designated sites, but they're also doing in other places. And there are not that many designated sites. I think NIH was one of the first. And then we really created more designated sites, Emory,
We and Emory started, I think.
Yes.
We were the first two.
Yeah, and then we had several, and it was funded by as per the Assistant Secretary for Public Preparedness and Response. And we worked with them for the infection control. But the problem, Bill, is that sometimes you don't know the person has. So that was a big lesson learned. And that's when I thought, you know, don't take anything for granted. Don't think you know, I always say, don't think you know how diseases are being transmitted. We wrote the book chapters saying how they are transmitted. Not the pathogens. The pathogens know other ways they can transmit, and we don't. So I always, I learn how to never take for granted, but also never quit. And always, I used to say, perfect data is the enemy of action. Perfection is the enemy of action. Because we would say, we need everything. In some situations, you have to act with what you have, and then you learn and you move forward. And that's the challenge, because when I think about you asking me the challenges in public health, it started with public reporting, that it was a challenge. It became a big positive thing, public reporting and elimination. The second was antimicrobial resistance, showing that infections are transmitted by colonized people moving around. It also became a big initiative to prevent infections. And the third was nobody care about healthcare-associated infections. We're the only ones. I remember when we would give talks to each other. And then because of Ebola, because of SARS, because of flu, it was clear that healthcare was an amplifier of transmission of emerging threats. Sure. And then everybody started paying attention to that. So this was the other, I think, major shift for the field, because then it became a big focus in how to address that.
Let me make just two points about that I think that are relevant. One is, it's a really good example of the difference between Denise's job and my job. I was worried about one unit in one hospital at that time, focusing on everything that we could focus on. And Denise's worried about 50 sites around the country where she has no direct control over what people are doing. It's really quite different. The other thing is it highlights what we talked about at the start, sort of the difference, how different the clinical center at the National Institutes of Health really is from other places. When back in the early 2000s, when SARS showed up, I bet I was the only hospital in the United States who had investigators writing protocols to study those patients, to bring them in, even though we didn't have any in the country, hardly. And we had, at that time, we had an old hospital that would have been a nightmare. I shudder to think about how hard it would have been to have done that. Mm-hmm. But that's what we do. That's what the clinical center does. And so if there's a problem like that, then we're just in it. Mm-hmm. And that's really different from a lot of other places.
I had the benefit. David was saying the beginning of working at NIH at the clinical center, having the positive thing and the negative thing about having very smart people who knew everything. I had the benefit of working with very smart people, not just at CDC, but in the, all over. When we talk for Bob Weinstein's podcast, I mentioned that. People I could call. People we could say, like, there was the meningitis outbreak. How do we do with this? We had no idea. Let's get a group and think together. So there was really a lot of fantastic people that I would call, or officially or not officially, to discuss what to do and discuss pros and cons and really learn in doing. Mm-hmm. But I would say at the end of the day, the friends were good, but we always criticized. I learned that didn't matter what I did, I would be criticized. I tell my friends that now I love going to meetings because nobody asks me for money. Nobody is upset at me because of a recommendation. Nobody's upset because they didn't get the grant. Or because of CMS. They would say, how come you start working with CMS? You sold our programs to. So now I can go, Bill, with a.
Yeah. So, I am going to say, as tough as that was, that I applaud people who, you said the criticism, that I can feel the tension that you experience. And I think it worked out for the better for everyone to have that tension and to work through it collaboratively. So,
if everybody had said yes, probably would not be where we are. Yeah. Because I think you always have to really have the ones who are critical about, so it makes you think twice. Again, it goes back to don't take for granted anything. So you can see that David and I, we are not at work. We still talk as if we are, and the excitement is still there.
I did mean to ask just. Hopefully, kind of briefly, this, David, you entered this field at the very beginning.
Yes, I did.
Why? what drew you to be a hospital epidemiologist?
It's sort of a convoluted story, but I'll tell it. I had finished my fellowship in infectious diseases. I was working in the laboratory with a guy named Jack Edwards, who was working on Candida albicans. Infections. They got me soft money for a year of a faculty salary at UCLA, Harbor UCLA. And I, halfway into the year, realized that I didn't have a job after that. And so I was trying to figure out where I was going to go. I was applying to jobs around the country. I was really pretty interested at that point in time in a career in clinical mycology. Jack Bennett who is still at the NIH, if you can imagine that, was the head of clinical mycology at the clinical center. And I had met him at an IDSA meeting with Dr. Edwards. And I had three job offers, and I called him up and said, Dr. Bennett, can you help me process through these job offers? Because you have a lot of experience and you know the field. What do you think about these three job offers? He said, I'm happy to help you do that, but let me give you a fourth option. He said, you could come back to the NIH Clinical Center and be our hospital epidemiologist. We've never had one, but we think we need one. And I have a position for that. And if you wanted to do that, you can come back and you can do hospital epidemiology with 5 or 10% of your time, and you'll have 90% of your time to work in the laboratory.
Yeah, that 5% that turned into a lot bigger.
Oh, that was first. And so, naive as I was, I went back and interviewed. I got creamed in the interview. I was on the list of people who I interviewed with was Anthony Fauci. That should tell you everything. I just got bludgeoned. And then I gave I was supposed to give a talk at 4:30 in the afternoon for 45 minutes. And I didn't get to the room to give the talk until 7 o'clock. And everyone was still in the room waiting on me. And I had been across the country giving these talks. You know, it's your standard canned talk talking about your science. And so I was finally relieved because I was going to be able to do this. And I put up the first slide and people started saying, what's on the x-axis of that graph? Did you have a control for this experiment? I sweat all the way through my suit, and I couldn't even spell epidemiology. And so at the end of the evening, we went to dinner about 9:30 to a Chinese restaurant in Bethesda. And I was sitting next to Dr. Bennett's wife, and she asked me if I had started looking for houses. And no one had offered me a job. So I said, well, Mrs. Bennett, she said, well, Jack, they love you. They want you to come. I said, someone should tell me that. So I was stunned. And so I came back to the clinical center. I had no training in epidemiology, none. I mean, what little do you get in a even back then in the, I guess it would have been the mid 1970s, no training in healthcare epidemiology. And so I learned on the job. And when I got there, as you've probably already guessed, there was no program in hospital epidemiology, no program in infection control, no infection control manual, nothing. And the whole first year I was there, I did nothing but try to put that program together and learn about what I was supposed to be doing. Mm-hmm. And I was fortunate enough to make friends with people at CDC who helped me. And I couldn't have done it without them. But about 3 years in, enjoying the healthcare epidemiology and not enjoying the laboratory experience as much. And then we got HIV infection. And it made, at that time, it made hospital epidemiology a full-time job for a lot of people. And it certainly did for me. And once I sort of helped the hospital through that, worked through that in the hospital, I was hooked. And I view healthcare epidemiology is my primary affiliation now, not infectious diseases or internal medicine, and really enjoyed my career in healthcare epidemiology.
Good. I'm going kind of long, so I do want to ask, I have kind of a signature question that I ask. I don't know if you had a chance to look. But it was more relevant for Cook County, for the clinicians. I'd ask about the doctor's bag. And so I'm going to phrase it, and we'll see how this works. But if you had one item, literal or figurative, to put in your health bag or public health bag, what would that be? David, do you want to start?
Sure. I did spend time thinking about this because I think it hits at one of the things that I find most distressing in my life currently. And that is, I think the country has lost track of science as a discipline and lost faith in science. And if I could have something that would at least allow a pathway back to having sensible reliance on scientific evidence. That would be the one thing I would put in my hospital bag for sure, because in the absence of that, I don't see how we're going to get better.
Denise?
I would say I will agree with the science. So I would say passion and science for impact.
Mm. I like it.
Because I think we forget the impact. So that's what I would say.
Very good. Okay. Well, thank you both. I know this went maybe a little long, but I appreciate you hanging
in. If you didn't stop us, we'll be here until tomorrow.
I could talk even longer.